At the Foot of the Cross, a monthly podcast from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales.
Well, hello everybody, and a very warm welcome to At the Foot of the Cross. And we are hurtling through summer, and it did seem to us to be quite a good time to look at what happens when we take a rest. I mean, we're all labourers in the vineyard. We're working very hard in our jobs. But you get to the June stage, particularly the middle of June and on, and you start to think a little bit about taking a healthy break. And that's where we're going to start with our regular studio guest, Abbot Hugh Allen. How are you?
I'm great, thank you, James, and thank you for inviting me back again. It's good to be chatting with you again and chatting about holidays. That's a nice thing to think about, really, isn't it? And you're right, you know, you get sort of June time and sort of the year is passing and you think, OK, the school holidays are coming closer and closer, and August really is the holiday month, isn't it? So that's sort of, yeah, there's a focus for that. I quite like that, really. We don't really do holidays in the monastery, oddly. We have time where we can go and be with our families, but we don't necessarily, you know, plan a Thomas Cook holiday all-inclusive to Benidorm.
No.
Maybe
jetting
we should.
Off.
Yeah, no jetting off in that sense. But everybody does need a time of rest. It's a really important thing. And we live in a world today that doesn't really like that very much. You know, it's constantly on the go. And, you know, this is what the Holy Father's talking about a bit in his encyclical, use of social media and the increasing presence of AI in that sense. We're constantly moving, constantly on the go.
And it's actually always on culture, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it's not, you can't do that. It's not human. And I rather like, there was a celebrity I heard about recently where she said she's never owned a mobile telephone. And she refuses to have one because she doesn't like the sensation of always being contactable. And I remember thinking, wow, I quite like that attitude. Actually, it's quite good that we all do need to have time where we can just turn off and just be on our own and just relax and take it easy. It's also part of the spiritual life. So in monastic life, we talk about something called the otium sanctorum. Now, otium sanctorum means holy leisure. You know, and the idea was that life in a monastery, in a monastic community, was meant to be one of holy leisure in a sense. So that, you know, for us in a monastery, we don't have the same tasks and commitments and responsibilities as other people do in a sense. And part of that was so that we could be at leisure, if you like, to somehow increase in our holiness, that we would have time to read, have time to pray, have time to do a bit more study, you know, that this would be part of our advancement in our vocation. But this idea of holy leisure, I think it's really beautiful. I mean, sadly, you know, in most monasteries, and mine included, there isn't really much leisure at all. And holiness, well, you know, it's a movable feast.
There's enough of that. There's enough.
We're working on it. It's all a work in progress.
Yeah.
But I think there's something really important about that sense of just being, and that we don't have to be doing everything all the time, and that we can slow down. And, you know, my first parish priest used to say, you know, the cemetery is full of people who thought they were indispensable. And really, none of us are. And so we should just accept that and enjoy that and embrace that and take time for ourselves, for our loved ones. You know, it's a really important thing to do, and not just spiritually, but for our whole life in a sense, you know, to make that time. So yeah, holiday season upon us. Don't have to necessarily go to Benidorm, but you know, it's important that people take time to rest. It really is.
Now, I'm going to ask this question because you sort of took it in this direction. So talking about the monastery, or certainly yours, do you have a sort of mobile phone culture, or is there that definite age to put it down?
So in my community, most of us are on call for hospitals. So Father Gildas for St. Thomas and Guy's, I'm on call for King's. So if you're on call, you have to have a phone. So, you know, it's a reality, but it is trying not to use it. And also just in a sense, I mean, mine's on silent most of the time, you know, on vibrate, so it doesn't disturb things. But it really is an important thing to, you know, basically put the phone down, if you like, to leave it to one side, that you don't allow that to encroach in life. Again, it's going back to the Holy Father's encyclical, you know, it's a healthy use of these things. You know, what's a good way of using this stuff and not allowing it to dictate who we are?
Well, to be honest, though, I mean, community life, I'm sure it has its downs as well as its many ups, but It is exactly that, isn't it? It's a community.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
So you are bonded in that sense. Yeah. But it must be hard when we talk about the 21st century pandemic of loneliness, don't we?
Yes.
And I do sometimes worry about some of our parish priests, because they're not immune, are they?
Oh, no one is. No one is ever immune to loneliness. And loneliness can even be when you're in a crowd, in a big group. You know, loneliness can seep in. And it can be something as well that sort of takes over without us realizing. You know, and easily leads into despair, which is the same. And that's why it's so important for us in our Christian journey that we remember that Jesus has said he'll be with us always. And so we're never abandoned. We're never alone. There is always someone that loves us, and that's Jesus Christ. And our relationship, our friendship with him, going back to what we were just saying, in a sense, is something that we need to give time to and not rush. And, you know, our life with God, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. And like any relationship, it needs time. And it's that relationship that assures us always that we're not alone and that we need to keep that in our hearts. Because, yeah, I do think we live in a sort of epidemic of isolation, of loneliness. You know, this thing of we can contact people more easily now, but actually, do we ever see someone? And, you know, again, you know, we believe in the presence of Jesus in our life. We go into the Catholic Church and we talk about the real presence of Jesus in the sacrament. Well, actually, in our friendships, in our families, we need to be real presence. You know, we really need to be part of what's going on. So, it's a really important thing.
And I think as well, you know, there have been occasions where, you know, working in communications, I'll be responding to emails. There'll be a lot of digital electronic communication. Mm. WhatsApp has taken over hugely in terms of short, sharp messaging, hasn't it?
Yeah, massively.
But then how many times, I don't know if you found this, I've just thought to myself, why am I typing out a long forensic email? Why don't I pick up the phone?
Yeah.
And I've actually stopped my email and made a phone call and thought, that was nice, because it's not face-to-face, but it's human connection, it's real, and it makes a bit of a difference.
Absolutely. It's also, you know, it saves time. You know, you just talk to someone, pick up the phone and speak.
Controversial.
You know,
and then,
I know, absolutely. But it's really important. You know, we do so much on the screen now, but you're right, that actually just speaking to someone and listening to their voice, and that can be something that breaks through the loneliness. You know, just knowing that someone's cared enough to pick up the phone and just speak to you. I mean, that's fantastic. I was talking to some priests about this recently, and you know, they were saying, the isolation, the loneliness, you know, we feel that no one ever sort of asks how we are. And I'm afraid I challenged them a bit. And I said, okay, I get that. I understand that. But when was the last time you did that? When did you ring up a friend and say, how are you? When did you pop in on a priest nearby and say, how's it going? Sometimes we need to just look at ourselves first and think, okay, how do I break this cycle? Not constantly looking outside for answers, but think, okay, I can be part of the solution to this. I can, you know, as the game show says, I can call a friend, you know. I think that's good to do. Or even someone who's not a friend, you know, just ring up and see how they're doing.
That normal human connection that we seem to sometimes lose, I think, in this day and age.
Absolutely. And again, Pope Leo's challenge about what's our humanity and not losing sight of our humanity through a screen. It's a means of communication. It's not an end in itself. My worth as a human being is not counted on how many likes I get on Facebook or on Instagram or whatever, you know, which a lot of people do now. You know, the young people who are obsessed by that and they're constantly trying to create things. You know, I live in South London on an estate, and it's unbelievable the amount of people I see filming themselves doing things to put on the internet. And it just feels a bit bizarre, really. It's just like, you know, well, you know, why not try just sort of getting on with life and enjoying it? And you know, you don't have to film everything. Well, I don't know.
No,
I'm so old-fashioned. I'm so sorry.
Don't apologise, because I actually
think
probably why the government's looking at that social media ban for under-16s.
I do get that. I'm not sure. I mean,
I'm not saying that's the mechanism.
Yeah, I think it's contrary to that. But, you're right.
Something's gone too far. I think we can at least say that it's unhealthy and there needs to be a sort of, you know, a sensibly thought-out solution.
It's pulling,
for our young people primarily.
Absolutely. It's pulling back and getting people again to make eye contact with each other. You know, that actually my focus shouldn't be what's in the palm of my hand, but instead, you know, the person in front of me, you know, someone I can talk to, a human being. and risking that. I think sometimes we're scared to do that now because of this, you know, we like to keep everything sanitized. That's the other thing, isn't it? When it's just on your phone, you can almost control it and it's sanitized and safe and fine, you know.
And literally at arm's length.
And literally at arm's length, when actually, you know, part of talking to someone is risking that that person might change your life. That might actually reveal something to you that means you need to change and develop. And they might also reveal to you the presence of Jesus Christ. So, you know, so conversations can be risky things. You know, if we really engage in it and listen to it, I think that's the importance as well of listening. I think sometimes, so often, we know we're listening, it can be a temptation to just let the other person talk and then just wait for them to finish and I'll say what I want to say.
Yeah.
You know, that's not listening. Listening is actually taking the risk to allow what someone says to change your life. And I think that's a really important thing we need to hold on to. And it means also welcoming the stranger, you know, not necessarily being scared of striking up a conversation. Sometimes it can be a bit annoying when people want to talk and things, but actually it is, as the adverts used to say, it's good to talk.
Isn't it just culture of encounter? But I have to say, I've taken us from our day-to-day talking about rest and recuperation human connection, into loneliness.
Well, it's all part and parcel of it, isn't it?
Oh,
you know, part
it is.
Of a holiday and resting and taking time is to reevaluate life and where you are with things. But also to open yourself up to these moments, because they are beautiful gifts from God. And,
well, they are.
You know, life is worth living. And, you know, we need to live it. It's there. Living in the present moment. Oh, James, it's so important. And it's such a beautiful gift from God. And sadly, you know, a lot of people either live in the past with their hurts and their pains and maybe their sins and sufferings, or they're completely anxious about the future, when actually what really matters is now. You know, when we say the Hail Mary, one of my favorite things about the Hail Mary is we ask our Blessed Mother to pray for us at the two most important moments in our life, now and the hour of our death. That's it. That's all that really matters, now and the hour of our death. And we ask our Blessed Mother to be with us in those moments, because actually that's what really counts. So on
Absolutely.
That, I'll stop talking, I promise.
Well, I am going to extend this ever so slightly, having said that, in that I did notice that it's the national pilgrimage in Wales to the Shrine of St. Winifred in the north of the country.
Yes.
I don't know if you've ever been there.
I have been to the Shrine of St. Winifred. It's very beautiful. I've been on a pilgrimage where there's mass in the Catholic Church, which is on the top of the hill, and then process down to the shrine with prayers and songs and things, and lots of people. And it's a beautiful sight. And it's one of those places, I don't know if you've ever heard this phrase, it's a thin place, that the gap between here and eternity is quite thin. You know, I don't know if you've...
Well, a beautiful phrase.
Yeah, it is. It's a lovely phrase, really. And it is. It has that sense about it, that you can tell this is a place where people have prayed for centuries, and that resonates in a place.
Wonderful. Well, that pilgrimage is on the 28th of June, hence why I brought it into this particular podcast.
Great.
Bishop Peter Brignall has spoken many times with great passion about St. Winifred's Shrine, particularly as he's actually sort of, in a sense, dedicated it to those that have been abused as well, which I think is very poignant, very moving,
which
and he
very
speaks
powerful.
Very well about that.
Yeah, and very powerful. I mean, yeah, and important. And the life of St. Winifred, you know, is a connection with that. But I think as well, the shrine itself, that despite, you know, the destruction that came and, you know, the removal of the people who prayed there and things, it's still there. And I think that's so often a survivor's experience, that they've had life destroyed, but somehow they're still here. And, you know, that they will always carry around that suffering, but they're still going and somehow, you know, I don't know how, because it's, you know, it's just so traumatic in a sense, but there's something incredibly powerful about the fact that they're still trying to keep going, you know. And I think the shrine itself speaks of that, you know, a place that suffered so much destruction and yet it's still there.
No, very well said. And as you say, that very moving point about it being a thin space, being so close potentially to the Lord.
Yeah, know? Really close to eternity, I think. Beautiful.
Wonderful. Now, look, the reason I mention this as well is to just speak to you about that notion of pilgrimage. We talk about rest, but there's also something to be said for a bit of spiritual activity. If you get those legs moving, if you're going to a shrine, going to a monastery, maybe even, you know, it doesn't have to be rural. You could take yourself to Peckham, couldn't you?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, everybody's welcome, you know. That's great, you know. No, it is. There's something really powerful about going to a place, you know, just the process. There's a beautiful Spanish phrase, and I can't speak Spanish, so I won't say it in Spanish, but that you make your path by walking it. And I think, you know, pilgrimage is something like that, that actually, you know, we're on our journey with God, and pilgrimage is a great example of that. It encapsulates it, that we're going from, perhaps going back to what we said earlier, isolation and loneliness, to connection with the Almighty. And the beautiful thing about God is that he isn't just our destination, he's also the journey, you know, that he's part of it. St. Paul tells us, you know, our real home, our true home is heaven, but the way we get there is by walking with God.
Now, look, we're nearing the end of our segment, but we should talk about two life issues, quite literally. Now, we spoke last month, didn't we, about Day for Life that will be celebrated Sunday, the 21st of June.
Wonderful.
Which we're looking forward to. And we've actually had a papal message for that, would you believe?
Oh, fantastic. Oh, it's amazing.
Which is really nice.
Yeah, no, that's great.
To get a message of... I mean, obviously, the Holy Father clearly is moved by the fact that it's the wonder of the child in the womb that has been taken as the theme.
Yep.
So he sent a message to via the nuncio to Archbishop John Sherrington, our lead bishop for life issues.
Oh, fantastic. That's wonderful.
So we shall share that online. Anybody wants to check that out, please do so. cbcew.org.uk/day-for-life. Bit of a mouthful, but you'll get there. Just search on the site if you don't. And also, you know, there's a bit of negative news, I have to say. We've talked over the last couple of years about assisted suicide. And the bill, the Terminally Ill Adults End of Life Bill, is likely to come back by virtue of a private member's bill in the autumn. So that's very disappointing. But also, it is that opportunity to explain why, obviously, we oppose this legislation.
Yeah, it's always like those moments, isn't it? It is really disappointing. You know, it's sad because whatever one's position may be on this issue, the bill itself is terrible. I mean, you know, the lead groups all say this, you know, and, you know, we should listen to what they're saying. You know, it's really important that we don't live in isolation, that so many groups involved in end-of-life care and in care of those who are sick and suffering are saying this is wrong, you know, and we should be listening to them. So it's really so sad, but like with all sad things, it's also a moment for us to say, well, actually, we think life is beautiful, and that we think that life from the moment of conception until the moment we go home to God is a beautiful gift. And, you know, we know that there are people who suffer so badly and they have to carry such a heavy cross, but it's part of our humanity, as Pope Leo reminds us in the encyclical, to carry the cross with them, to love them and care for them. And actually, you know, that's part of our message, that part of our love and our desire to love is because we're called to do that for everybody in whatever state of life they're in, from the moment that they're conceived and until they go home to God, that they are someone who has a dignity and a worth that no one can take from them. And we really need to proclaim that and shout it from the rooftops, because it's beautiful, it's wonderful. And even in the midst of suffering, you know, we're called to love, and we should really hold on to that.
No, absolutely. And we obviously have our principled objection. We do make that clear.
Very.
There are those points, as you say, those concerns that carry through from the last attempt to legalise assisted suicide. Those concerns remain all the more acutely. So we'll be raising our voice on that.
Absolutely.
But on top of that, though, you know, there would be that point to be made about placing the emphasis in a better place.
Yeah.
Right now, in the here and now, making good palliative care available to all.
Absolutely.
Supporting the hospice movement, which is a jewel in the crown.
Oh,
if anyone's seen good hospice care, I mean, it is fantastic. But it should be better invested in.
It should be better invested in, and it shouldn't be a lottery for people either. It should be something that's there for everyone to take that. And, you know, my own father died in a nursing home, and his care was incredible. And they gave him so much dignity in his final days. It was wonderful to see. You know, that's what we need to treasure. And that's where our focus should be, in looking after people and taking care of them. And it's not about saying, well, we're taking away people's rights or whatever. That's not what it's about. It's about saying, what does it mean to be a human being? And to be a human being basically means to care for each other and to love each other. And that doesn't stop just because, you know, there are problems and difficulties. In fact, that's where it comes into its own. That's where it really matters. And that's what we really want to share with the world we live in, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, the rest of this podcast is dedicated to Life Issues, Day for Life, we'll be hearing from Archbishop John Sherrington, talking about the message that the three bishops that represent the bishops' conferences of England and Wales, Scotland and Ireland, that message is a joint message.
Fantastic.
And we shall hear from the Biblical Apostolate Manager, Fleur Dorrell, as we do every month. And you've given us the spirituality, the theology, if you like, of rest. Fleur's going to talk about rest and the Bible.
Oh, well, that's quite a big thing in the Bible. So that's good. That's
She's doing that. We'll challenge her to do that in 10 minutes.
No. It's one of the beautiful things, isn't it, in the life of our Lord. You know, when we read this in the Gospels, that, you know, he'd spent his day preaching and healing and doing things. And then he would go to a lonely place to rest and pray. And I think that's a good example for all of us.
Well, let's pick that up with Fleur Dorrell now.
Wonderful. Thanks, James.
Thanks very much.
God bless.
Thanks.
God bless. Bye-bye.
We've reached that point in our June podcast where we're going to be talking all things scripture, quite right too. And this time, I think it's really interesting, we're going to look at scripture and the idea of rest. Because of course, you know, it's that time of year when our schools, colleges, universities, they're starting to break up or think about doing so. And as workers, as humble workers in the vineyard, Fleur, we're seeking some rest as well. Why not? Let's get away from this 24/7 pressured culture and think about recovering, recharging those batteries so we can work harder when we come back. Now, the scriptures surely have something to say about this, Fleur. So where do you want to start?
They do indeed, James. So the Bible speaks very clearly on our need for rest. Its basis is found right at the beginning in Genesis chapter 2. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished and all their multitude. And on the seventh day, God blessed the work that he had done, and he rested on the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from all the work that he had done in creation.
Well, I guess if rest is good enough for God, it should be good enough for us. Was he exhausted in this work of creating?
Well, that's a nice idea, but I think actually it's saying something different, because actually there's no suggestion in the Genesis text that God actually struggled to create. Indeed, each day he looks on the fruit of his work and sees that it is very good. He rejoices in its richness and fertility. So God's work is not like our human toil and struggle, draining us of energy, feeling like lots of effort. God's rest isn't escape or relief from working.
So in that sense, what is God showing us through his resting on the seventh day?
Well, the scriptures understand that when the deepest aspirations of the human spirit are not met, this makes itself felt in our bodies. We become ill. We all have an experience of this. The Sabbath is God's gift to us, helping us to realise that our lives are ultimately not what we struggle to make of them, but what we receive from the gifting love of God. So the day God rested is a day of delight. And interestingly, the Sabbath is the only named day of the week in the Hebrew calendar. It's a day of blessing that we're all invited to share in, to enter its delight from the joyful and generous love of God.
So, Fleur, God builds rest and recreation into the very structure of creation then?
Yes, that's absolutely right, James. And one of the great medieval rabbis, Rashi, suggests that this day of rest, of God's tranquility and peace, is something we're invited to share. And as we share in it, we grow in our understanding of what's truly important, of the purpose of creation. And fundamentally, this is about realising what things truly are, what is good, what is to be cherished and celebrated. The medieval mystic Dame Julian of Norwich also sees this in her revelations of divine love, as she says, "All shall be well and all manner of things shall be well."
Ah, but Fleur, as you know, it's not always so easy to find this divine rest, even when we're on holiday.
Yes, that's true, James. And perhaps it's helpful to remember that the opposite of God's rest is not so much activity, but restlessness. When we are restless, we cannot delight in others, the world around us, or even in ourselves, with what we have and who we are. But the resting on the seventh day embraces all that leads to a more hospitable world. It's a celebration of the variety of God's creativity, an opportunity to enter more richly into the vision of a world loved and sustained in being by God.
Okay then, so it's the opportunity to see the world as gift, which is to be consciously cherished, is that right?
Yes. Rest here is to delight in an ever more discerning and aligned way to God's desire that everything should be very good. This understanding will eventually find a mature expression in the commandments in the book of Exodus, chapter 20, where the good of all creatures depends on their inclusion into the divine Sabbath rest. It says, "The seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. You shall not do any work, you, your son or your daughter, your male or female slave, your livestock or the alien resident in your towns."
I like the idea, actually, that the animals and vulnerable strangers are included in this day of rest.
Yes, I do too, James. And the prophet Jeremiah will later make it very clear that the fall of the nation was due precisely to its inability to rest on the Sabbath. It had lost the vision that enabled it to keep things in balance in Jeremiah chapter 17. So the Sabbath is not pure passivity and collusion with the way things are. It links us to God's active, sustaining love of the whole of the world he created.
I like the use of the word balance there, Fleur. So are you saying then that it provides us with the time and space to reflect on how we've acted and how indeed this has affected others and other creatures, for instance?
Yes, because the scriptures restate this by again referring back to the founding act of God, liberating the Hebrew slaves. Deuteronomy 5 says it clearly. "Remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day." So the ongoing mechanism of salvation, then, is now, as it was then, to honour the Sabbath rest.
So in those salvific terms, then, how does this mechanism work out, Fleur?
Well, as the people reflected on the implications of God's Sabbath rest, the focus was not just on men and women, and indeed on slaves, but on the participation of the land itself and its creatures. Leviticus chapter 25 makes this very clear. "In the Sabbath year, the land will enjoy rest with no sowing, pruning, or planting. The people are to live off what the land gives, trusting in God and receiving and gathering, rather than controlling the place in which they live. So early on, we learn not to grasp, but to live generously with other creatures and life forms on the land. And that's something we still really do struggle with."
Is that what leads to this idea of the Jubilee year, like the one we celebrated last year?
Yes, it does. So every 50 years was the Jubilee year, the Sabbath of the Sabbaths, where the idea of rest is taken to another level. All those who, by whatever circumstances, have lost their land or freedom are to be restored to their family homes, says Leviticus 25, verse 8. And the profit and ownership of the land and of their ancestors must not be expanded at the cost and basic rights of others, since God is always the ultimate owner of that land anyway. Isaiah 5, verse 8 addresses the consequences of this warning and this greed. "Woe to you who join house to house, who add field to field, until there is room for no one but you, and you are left to live alone in the midst of the land."
So if we're to follow the regular practice of Sabbath rest, then our actions and wisdom must come together for the benefit of all, not just ourselves. Is that right?
Exactly. It expresses the possibility of a new humanity based on equality and the elimination of all exploitation. In the powerful words of St. Augustine in his book The City of God, he says that if we do eliminate this exploitation, then in the final time and fulfillment of creation, we ourselves will be the seventh day.
I like that, Fleur. I'm classing this little reflection as the mandate to rest. You allow me to step off the pot and rest a bit. I like
definitely,
it.
Definitely.
But there's certainly a lot more to rest than at first seems to be the case, I must say. It's quite literally recreation as well as recreation, is it not?
Yes, it is. That is the whole point.
Love it. Fleur, thank you so much. Stay with us for these summer months. We might
thank
take
you.
A little break in August, but I know you'll be back with us in July.
Thank you. I will indeed. It's always a pleasure, James.
Thank you very much, Fleur. We can definitely hear how the Bible speaks clearly to us about the need for rest, right from Genesis, creation, and God resting on the seventh day. Now, you may remember a little earlier when we were talking to Abbot Hugh, we discussed this year's Day for Life, celebrated in our parishes on Sunday the 21st of June. Our lead bishop for life issues, Archbishop John Sherrington, who's also the Archbishop of Liverpool, is one of three bishops representing the Episcopal Conferences, the Bishops' Conferences of England and Wales, Scotland and Ireland, to promote the day and its theme, The Wonder of the Child in the Womb. We conclude our podcast today with an interview that Archbishop Sherrington gave to our senior media officer, Steph McGillivray. Over to you, Steph.
Archbishop John Sherrington, thank you so much for joining us. You are, of course, the Archbishop of Liverpool, but also the lead bishop for life issues for the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. And today we are here to talk about Day for Life, which is coming up on the 21st of June. Day for Life is the day in the Church's year dedicated to raising awareness about the meaning and value of human life at every stage and in every condition. And we know that it's celebrated on the third Sunday of June each year, this year, as I say, on the 21st of June. Now, this year, the bishops have chosen the theme, The Wonder of the Child in the Womb. And I wondered if you could please, first of all, just tell us a bit more about this theme and this year's campaign.
Well, thank you very much, Steph. I'm very pleased to be able to speak to you today. So this year, the three bishops' conferences, England and Wales, Scotland and Ireland, chose the theme, The Wonder of the Child in the Womb, because again, we want to highlight the wonder of the child, that when a woman becomes pregnant, so often there's joy, there's excitement for the future, and there's this child that's beginning to grow in the womb. We want to highlight the joy of this, the gift of the child, especially as articulated and sung in the Psalms of the Old Testament, the wonder of the child that God has created that is in the womb.
Thank you. And as you, with the other bishops, mention in this year's message, for parents who have lost a child in the womb or perhaps shortly after birth, those parents are particularly able in a special way to recognise that wonder and humanity of their child. And we know that the loss of a child is a particular form of grief, which isn't often spoken about or perhaps is still considered maybe even taboo in some parts of society. So we wondered why the bishops have chosen to speak on this subject now.
I think it's very important because, as you say, there are many women who are carrying a lot of pain because of a miscarriage or stillbirth or perhaps the loss of a child soon after birth. It's an area that the Church in the past has not dealt particularly well with. As you say, there was a lot of privacy, there was a lot of not talking about these things for whatever reason. And so we thought that in entering into this reflection, particularly on Father's Day, was an opportunity to open up this painful area so that the grief can be identified and the Church can help women and parents through grief, through prayer, through support. But that it's important to name this because unless we name the truth of situations, then they remain covered up. So naming the truth and the loss of a child is a way of being compassionate and also beginning to help a parent or a woman to process the grief of the loss of that child.
And speaking of that prayer and support through the Church, I wondered if you could tell us a bit more about that support through the Church. What's available for couples and families who are suffering the loss of a child?
Well, I think that there is the possibility of praying with the person. I think our chaplains in hospitals are now much better at being able to be present at such loss. I remember as a parish priest being called to the hospital after a delivery of a child that had been born dead from the womb. And then I prayed with the mother, and then later she wanted a service at the crematorium. And we prayed, it was full of grief. And this was a couple from Zimbabwe. And we went for the burial in the graveyard. And I thought, what could I do to help this couple in their grief? Because they were just so lost. And I said, what would you do at home? What would you sing? How would you mark this loss? And then they knew what to do. So they started their songs, their cultural approach to this baby's death, and it was very beautiful. And I felt that being able to say that and not knowing what to do, but to say, what would you do at home, actually helped them immensely to grieve for the loss of their child. So we can find ways. Another situation from the hospital was to actually conduct the funeral rites for another child that had died very quickly after birth. And the couple were from the Congo and didn't really speak much English. So I found a French rite and in my poor French led the little funeral rite. And I think that helped them. So we can find creative ways of helping people in their grief. A couple can always have a mass offered for anybody living or dead. And also within the parish community, there will be other women who have lost children in this way. They may be a source of support, being able to talk to another woman, the support that comes through the parish or through other groups that can be supportive to mothers who have lost their children.
It's wonderful that the church is speaking into this issue and is able to provide that support. And those are just wonderful examples of, as we say, sometimes meeting people where they are and that moment of encounter. I wondered now if you could tell us a bit more about the Day for Life Fund and the sort of support that it provides for pro-life causes in England and Wales. What kind of organisations and work does the Day for Life Fund support?
Just before I answer that question, it comes to mind that one of the most consoling things that anybody can do is to go into a church and light a candle and say a prayer for the little child. Often parents will have given the child a name in the womb or some form of name, and they can always light a candle and say that prayer. And that is something you can do privately without fuss, but can be very consoling. So, coming back to your question about the Day for Life Fund. In England and Wales, we take a collection on this day, and this is to fund activities and groups who work in pro-life situations. So there will be some of the funding that will be given to local groups within dioceses who may be reaching out in bereavement groups or who are working in childcare in some way, voluntary groups or small charities that are providing a local help to people in need. And then we also, as a church, fund some of the larger charities who are working on pro-life issues. So the fund, much reduced now since COVID, will be used for various ways of supporting pro-life activities. And we do give some account of that on the Bishops' Conference website. So you will know that if you do contribute, then your monies are being used either locally or nationally by the church in accord with pro-life activities.
Thank you, Archbishop John. And as you say, you can find out much more information on the Bishops' Conference website, www.cbcew.org.uk, where there is lots of information available about Day for Life and also about how to donate online. But you can also donate during the second collection in your parish on the 21st of June. Thank you very much, Archbishop John, for sharing your experiences and also all of this very important information about the Day for Life Fund with us.
Thank you very much, Steph.
Thanks very much, Steph, and of course to our lead Bishop for Life Issues, Archbishop John Sherrington. That's it for this episode of At the Foot of the Cross. Thanks for being with us as we've talked about the theology of rest with its biblical mandate and also our focus on Day for Life. It's an opportunity on that day, as we always do, to uphold the dignity of life from conception to natural death. For now, take care, and we'll be back with another At the Foot of the Cross podcast very soon indeed.